From producer Douglas Gresham, stepson of C.S. Lewis, and not from Disney, not from Fox, likely not even from Walden Media, but from the Mark Gordon Company and producer Mark Gordon, producer of The Day After Tomorrow and 2012. Just might come another epic adventure in the fantastic and cinematic land of Narnia. A land without its prince. A land ripe for invasion by an evil witch. But one man, one Marshwiggle, and two children will face their destinies in the wastelands of the north. Their mission, to find the lost prince. Their guide, the Word of Aslan. And they will fight giants, brave mountains, descend to the foundations of the world, and save all Narnia from evil.
Okay, so you guys ready?
Yes.
I am ready. I've been ready for the past... How long have you been waiting for... How long has it been since we had a legitimate news podcast?
Okay, let me check.
Go ahead and check.
April Fool's was the one.
But I guess you could say it was back in June 2012 was when we did the one about Gresham saying he wanted to make the movie...
June 2nd.
Independent.
2012?
That's when we had... But that was just the story about him saying maybe he was going to make it independently. We did I think the last really legitimate news story was probably November 2011. So almost 2 years, and here we are.
Another
news podcast, and good to have you back, Ransom.
Hey, it's excellent to be back, and good to catch up with something that seems like news, at least so far.
Yeah. Oh, this is definitely news. This is by far the biggest news.
Of course.
By far the biggest news to come out in the past few years.
Definitely. I mean, it's. I remember where I was standing.
We're totally doing a news podcast right now. This feels so nice.
Okay. First, let's just talk about where we were. Glumpuddle, you called me, so you should go first. Where were you?
Oh,
when we heard about Silver Chair.
When I found out, I was actually at work. I was editing something. And then I saw, and it totally took my eye off the ball. I was really fighting a deadline. But nonetheless, even though I was up against a deadline, I ran outside and called you, and we talked for a little bit.
Yeah.
Then I spent a little bit of time on the forum. Then I called Tyrion, and we talked for a little bit. And then I got back to actually doing what I'm paid to do.
But I was technically, I guess you'd say, in my office. And I just get this call, and it's you. And you're saying, go to NarniWeb. And once you say, go to NarniWeb, I thought, it can only be one thing, but surely not. I just thought, no way. But this is the only thing that would make sense for Glenfiddle to do this. And I look at, and, you know, I pulled out my phone and looked, oh my goodness.
It's
real. And sure enough. Yeah. How about you, Ransom?
Well, obviously, I was sitting in front of my computer screen. I must have been in my office because it was just a few days ago. So yeah, I was cautious. Well, we'll get to the reactions later, but I wanted to say I'm cautiously optimistic, and then I realized no, I am only cautious.
Well, it's funny. Tyrion was telling me that, like, I think initially when he saw the news, he wasn't quite sure just how big it was. Obviously, he was gonna he posted immediately, but kind of wondered if maybe it was a situation like The Lion Awakes, where they keep saying, yeah, we're going to make this movie. And because just the fact that they announced it in a Twitter post seemed a little anticlimactic. But then when they had the press release with the quote from Gresham and Gordon
story.
And the guy from the C.S. Lewis company, then it became clear, wow, this looks much more legit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it still seems at this stage, though, to be... I mean, other films will be like Marvel cinematic films right now. They will say, hey, here's our director, here's our cast, here's our release date, we're going. This seems, I mean, much further behind even something like the still theoretical Justice League film that Warner Brothers put together. Justice League may be a few steps ahead, but not by far. This is still seemingly tentative.
I see this as the announcement that it's not in development hell anymore. Now it's just in development. It was in development. Now it's in development.
Early development, yes.
And I actually don't think it's a 100. I get the sense it's maybe not quite a 100% green lit. I think it's like 95%.
Here's a good way to think of it. I mean, you know, Peter Jackson was working on the Lord of the Rings. He had models and concept art.
Yeah.
And even early stuff for the Dead Army.
Uh-huh.
Back in 1997, before New Line picked it up. I mean, so this is almost like the pre-New Line days. I mean, yes, they're moving ahead, they're working on it, but it's never going to be, I mean, really, until they're actually filming, it's no film is completely assured to be made.
And since
they haven't even bought a green mist machine yet.
Yeah.
Shut up. You're banned from the council from now on.
We'll get to that. That's a topic for that's definitely one of the topics we'll get to. But in terms of release date, you know, we don't have a release date of any kind. And, you know, the first question that comes up is Walden Media. Like, when can they release it? When can they start filming? The whole 2018 number was just something that I sort of threw out there as an estimate. I did, you know, just did a little math and said, well, I guess 2018 seems like it would probably be the earliest. Does that mean they can start developing a movie and scripting and maybe even shooting before date?
Talking to Tyrion on the phone, he thinks that you could. That's only for releasing it. That as long as you're not going to release it before that time. And for those of you who don't know, we're talking about the rights to the film. Glenpuddle, you probably remember the details, because there's a difference between, because you can own the rights to make a film without owning the rights to release it.
You know, the long story short is that no film, until we believe about 2018, it's you can't make a Narnia film without Walden Media. So the fact that they're announcing this indicates that I guess maybe they can start filming or something, as long as they don't release it before 2018. And when I say 2018, that's just an estimate. It could be earlier, it could be later. But maybe they can just start, you know, developing it and then just release it after the moratorium expires.
Okay, it's kind of starting from the get-go. You know, there's a poll on the front page. How did you guys vote?
I just now voted because I looked at that question and thought, oh, poll on the front page. Yes. Earlier I said that I wanted to be cautiously optimistic, which happens to be one of the poll options. I said instead that I was just cautious. The closest match to that on the in the poll, if I suppose I can let our entire vast podcasting audience into the ballot box with me. The way I voted was, actually, my position might be a little bit close. It might be directly in between and I have a bad feeling about this.
Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. Maybe I should have made like 10 more options to.
Oh, you made the poll. Okay, yeah, that's all right. I'm not going to pick on the candidates. I'm no write-in. I'm not asking for that.
Glenpuddle, how did you vote?
I also voted even though, to be honest, my first reaction was yes! 4 exclamation points. But it was more of the excitement of what we're doing right now. Another news podcast.
Well, that is what the question says. It's a Silver Chair Next, Mark Gordon producing, your reaction.
Right, but like...
It doesn't say initial reaction, it does say reaction.
Silver Chair Next, Mark Gordon producing, yes! Oh my, another Narnia movie, just because I was excited to get back into that. Making videos, the forum, podcast, having something new to praise or criticize every week.
Okay, I'm very glad you said that, Glumpuddle, because unfortunately, the yes reaction... on my part was also more of a pragmatic pundit than a fan. It's terrible because now it's like, okay, it's not like I get paid to do this or anything, but still like, oh, all right, you know, another conversation started. You know, I've been on this for, you know, 10 years now, so this can slip right back into that role.
Yeah. Well, I can't believe this, but I also voted.
So we should no we diversity just... here.
I think that's going to be the title of this episode. It's basically like the Silver Chair announced.
So why are we doing this podcast? We don't represent the majority opinion at all. Right now, if we have 48% saying yes and 21% saying cautiously optimistic. In third place, we have just released there's going to be a Narnia 4 at all. And then you got,
I think that was Jim Fan.
Well, my West reaction was more negative. It was if perhaps that, well. I guess that's only reflected by this 3% or 2%. So it was.
Ransom is more on the negative side in some ways, and Glumpuddle, I think you're a little more on the positive side.
I don't know. I mean, like, cautiously optimistic. I really get that because I think the fact that they're making this making this with Mark Gordon. So it's just, at this point, it's an independent film, essentially. Yeah. And, you know, we can think about probably going to be in a lower budget. And all those things could be just as much potential to be good as they are to be bad. Means there's less money on the table. There's fewer people trying to protect their investment. And if you get the right guy, maybe even though it's a lower budget, they could come up with a more interesting, a less formulaic, more interesting Narnia film. So this does have potential to be something really great. But I don't know. All I have to say is,
Well, it's kind of like, and it kind of goes to like the next question of really how do you anticipate this film, especially with respect to the first three films? And you almost can't use those.
You almost can't.
Other than to say, man, there's a wide spectrum of possibilities here. Yep. I mean, because really, like, you know, I say the first two films were good. They were not excellent movies. They were not masterpieces, but they were good. They were enjoyable, and I think they were good filmmaking, good storyline. They were good adaptations. Not great, but they had definitely issues.
There are definitely people listening who want to chime in and say, what? You liked Prince Caspian? And yeah, I think all three of us are, to an extent, Prince Caspian defenders. And,
yes. Yeah.
And there's sort of a mixed reaction, I think, among Narniaers about Prince Caspian.
But Prince Caspian is underappreciated. I think we can say that.
I think it is too. But there's definitely people listening right now who want to chime in and say, what? And talk about, what about Peter? What about this?
Yeah. Even with that, there is a huge spectrum of possibilities here. And I think that, I mean, that's why I was telling, like, here's the thing. I am overall in an elated state of emotion. And here's why. I mean, I told Tyrion, I said, you know, here's the thing. Even though The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, even though I, you know, and Glumfuddle, I've still never forgiven you for the fact that you own that thing.
A used copy for reference purposes.
There's video evidence of it. Isn't it wonderful that they put the White Witch on, like, the entire one wing of the packaging?
But seriously, even though I do not even, I'll probably never watch that again, the Voyage of the Dawn Treader movie. I'll never watch it again, but of course I had fun on the journey. I had fun ripping it apart. I had fun watching the Spyro Forts. I mean, because the journey of a Narnia lover is fun. I'm in the middle here. I mean, yeah, it could be good or bad. I'm back to square one. I am just as optimistic or less so about this film as I was about The Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe.
Where it's just the abyss of the unknown.
Exactly.
We're just waiting to get more details, especially since there's no director attached even. And
exactly.
All I'm getting is, look, there's very likely going to be another Narnia film. It's going to be The Silver Chair, and it's probably going to have a lower budget. And that's the part where I go, that could be a really good thing, or it could be a really bad thing. We'll just have
it could be. I just realized just now that my reaction to this, and of course this is slightly different because I did not grow up with Star Wars the way that so many people did, but my reaction to this is similar to the announcement of further Star Wars films, a further Star Wars trilogy. It's different, again, because they have actually announced that J.J. Abrams is the director for that. There's more concrete information, including a release time. But it's very similar in that most people love the original Star Wars trilogy, and most people were severely disappointed by the prequels, almost to Dawn Treader levels, scraping bottom. And now people are a little bit more excited. They perk up. New films, you know, original cast. There's, again, more concrete details being announced for that. So there's potential for more excitement there. But as for me, I feel almost the exact same. I'm thinking, well, maybe it won't be as bad as the prequels, but still, you know, I have a bad feeling about this.
Well, why do you have a bad feeling about it exactly? I'm trying to get a feeling about it, and
I'm curious.
like I voted.
I would like to know more about primarily the direction that they'll go with the adaptation, because and that is solely based on some problems with Prince Caspian's adaptation, where they just did not seem to understand the themes of the book, even though they made a good story, a good movie based on the themes that they did go with, a decent movie. Don Treader was just so cliche, and we've been there in these podcasts before, so I won't belabor that point. But I want to know that they understand the themes of The Silver Chair. There's such a depth there that they need to understand in order to make the story work.
Well, even, and I told this, I've said this before, I don't know how many times on the podcast, and I said it to Tyrion just the other day. You know, the way I kind of explain, the shortest way I have to explain all of the issues, good and bad, with all three of the first films, is Andrew Adamson, I would say, had a basic understanding of the story. True. It wasn't very in-depth, but he did understand the basics
of
it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think. I don't think he completely understood it, but I think he really liked the books.
That's what I'm going to say. Is that helps. He had a basic understanding. It wasn't very in-depth, but he did have a basic understanding of it, and he clearly loved and respected them. He certainly loved and respected the stories more than he understood them. And so you had that, which I think explains a lot of the issues. You know, the first two were obviously came across as very well crafted with love and care and attention. But there were some things like a great example is the fact that the way they threw in the line about when every day you grow, so shall I.
Which is wrong.
The fact they threw it in there shows that they cared, but they didn't understand. They just missed it. But the Voyage of the Dawn Treader was made by a director who neither cared for nor understood
the
story.
That's the sense we get. And you have to kind of read between the lines there. But that is, you do get the sense that Apted
wasn't
the
way
as
I explain
enthusiastic
it is,
about the project as Andrew Adamson was.
I think that, you know, the fact that he said, you know, oh, there's no reason for the voyage in the book. I mean, that
we've been there.
Yeah, but so that's kind of the way I look at this, you know. So in some ways, you could almost... You really need both. It's not just understanding. You need someone who, of course, cares about the project, which that's kind of a first rule in film anyway.
Mm-hmm. The narrative structure of The Silver Chair happens to align more closely with what most movie makers seem to understand. Direction-based quest to save a world.
It's more of more of a road journey with a specific quest in mind, and unlike the other Narnia films up to this point, this is something I'm sure we'll probably talk quite a bit about as we're anticipating this movie, is the fact that Silverchair was the first Narnia book written with a clear main character, that being Jill Pohl. Wardrobe, Caspian, and Don Treader don't have a clear main character. And so I think up to this point, the Silverchair has the most traditional, you know, movie kind of framework.
More so
than the other ones.
Yes. Yeah. And in that sense, a film adaptation of that may, even by accident, be better. not so much because you know, the makers got particularly wise, but because Lewis happened to be more closely aligning with what most people understand now as a traditional fantasy quest.
And the thing about Don Treader was I believe they. It was so kind of unlike your typical movie in terms of it was episodic. It didn't have, you know, a villain in it. And and so they felt the need to introduce things like the Green Mist. Oh, we got to have a villain in there. Even Apted himself said all great adventure stories have to have a villain, which, of course, I disagree with. And I just mean typical movie. There are movies like Forrest Gump that are very episodic. Yeah. Very, very character driven that are great.
They need to be handled well. They take more skill.
Yeah, but now you just wonder here's what I'm really wondering. Will decisions like the Green Mist that was made, you know, to try to make it more like a movie, they could affect this movie, because we know the Green Mist was supposed to at some point tie into the Lady of the Green Kirtle. She was either supposed to be causing the Green Mist, or maybe she's the Green Mist incarnate. You know, there's all kinds of things it could have been. But so what I want to know is, this is a fresh start in a lot of ways. You know, we may have a whole new cast. We'll get to that. But I'm wondering how many decisions that were made in Don Treader are going to come back in Silver Chair, like the Green Mist.
Yeah.
The name dropping of Jill Pohl at the very last.
Yeah, I wonder. So saying that they've been friends for a while, yeah.
I'll first say, kind of going back to your point, Ransom, I think that you're kind of right. Because I think even looking at the BBC series, The Silver Chair is certainly the least painful/most enjoyable of those, in my opinion.
And not only because of Tom Baker.
I agree with that.
Tom Baker for the win.
Tom Baker is Huddle Glum, yep.
Right. Well, no, I just felt like that one flowed better. And maybe it's partly because, you know, it's cheaper to plop some people somewhere in Ireland or Northern Britain than it is to build a whole set, you know.
That's true with this film as well, by the way. We've been saying for years, if you were going to make a Narnia – but a low-budget Narnia book, you'd probably make it The Silver Chair. And I think you just look at BBC, you can kind of see why. One of the reasons being that the BBC version of Silver Chair is more, I think, easier to sit through than the other two. And again, just in fairness, there are plenty of dedicated Narnia fans who love the BBC
versions. Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
And I totally get that, and I respect that. But yeah, I think The Silver Chair is the best one, in part because we don't have to deal with talking animals very much.
Right.
That's right. None of that lip syncing which definitely helps, because I believe the effects studio for the last, at least the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe has gone belly up since then. Yep. That's unfortunate.
Well, I think it's kind of, you mentioned the studio. Do we want to kind of get this, like, our questions about the studio crew out of the way first?
Sure.
Let's start with Will Poulter.
Start with what?
Will Poulter, perhaps. I regret that I'm guessing he is 20 years old. I checked his wiki page. I'm guessing he will not be able to play Eustace.
I think a lot of people don't realize that when they say, well, I don't know, he'll be a little old. And of course, I understand that. I guess we shouldn't rule it out entirely now that I think of it. I did see a video of him recently and just went, wow, he is old. I don't know. I don't think we should completely rule out the possibility entirely.
Will Poulter was, I'll just say, I mean, I think he's, boy, dare I say it, the best cast of all the seven friends of Narnia in all three films.
I think either Skander or Georgie still get that one.
Skander is pretty amazing. I might hand it to Skander first, but still, I would just say, you know, it's a big world. There's certainly one other very capable good actor for Eustace they could find.
Sure.
True. It would be so nice for consistency, kind of though.
It would work nice for consistency, although it might also be better if you weren't, you know, able to grow a beard for consistency.
What do you guys want to happen? Would you like, even though I think most people like Will Poulter, but, and this is a question for the comments section, even though most of us like Will Poulter, would you just want him to be recast? Before you post a comment, look at a recent video of Will Poulter.
True. Yes. You need to know what he actually looks like rather than Don Treader version from 2009.
Right.
Well, yeah. Well, he even changed between, like, just the release. I mean, I saw videos of him at the premiere. I thought, oh, my goodness, he looks different.
They got to hurry.
Yeah. So, I mean,
it's not happening. He would be at least 22 by the time they're ready to start filming. And that's older than I believe Daniel Radcliffe was playing 17-year-old Harry Potter.
Uh-huh.
That's true.
I still think it's a small possibility. I mean, Ben Barnes is 25. He played Caspian. And, like, I mean, they might just say Silver Chair takes place maybe 4 or 5 years after Don Treader. They may just make that change and decide they want an older Eustace.
Still at boarding school, though.
True. Well, they could change that. I hope they don't.
Perhaps he's a TA at Experiment House.
Okay. I don't think it's a total impossibility.
No, that's not a total impossibility, but I just would feel like the Will Poulter as Eustace thing, if that were a big priority for them, they should just take the attitude, hey, we should just make this, and when it's time to cast, if he works as well as every other, better than every other contestant, we'll just keep him. But I don't think he's amazing enough. They should make him a huge priority, or throw out someone who they would see as just as good and a better age. Uh-huh. Especially because, you know, we could talk about consistency, but in some ways it's almost easier for an audience to go with a new actor who's at least a more believable age than if the real actor looks a lot older.
I wonder if he's still under contract. I suppose he signed on for – he probably signed on for more than one Narnia film.
But wouldn't that be with Walden?
Yeah, that's what I don't know. I don't know how much of that is still
– Yeah, that's a good question.
Imagine there's all kinds of lawyers trying to sort that out, or they will be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But a
brand new Eustace would, I mean, like, one of the things that's exciting about this for me is a clean slate, a fresh start.
Yes.
And, you know, right now the talk about is, because what have we been talking about the past, you know, couple of years? Could they just reboot the series potentially? And I think the reaction in general has been, oh, they're making Silver Chair. I guess they're not rebooting. But I just kind of wonder. I mean, I think I've been using the example of Batman Forever, which is
it's a horrible example, but I get your point. I get your point.
I'll use the example anyway. But is it a sequel to the other two Batmans? Yes, but with a new cast, totally new feel. Yeah. And they only kind of vaguely acknowledge the events of the other two films. So it even though it's technically a sequel and technically in that continuity, it feels like a reboot. Feels like a total fresh start. And I think there's the opportunity to do this, especially if you recast Eustace and Aslan and Ben Barnes. There's such an opportunity to say, yeah, it's a sequel, but we're also going in a different direction at the same time. And I know that sounds confusing, but I think Batman Forever is a good example.
One thing I did want to hit on, and Glenfell, I think you hit on it earlier, was the budget. Frankly, you know, these days, filmmaking is changing so much now on so many levels, whether it's, you know, the discussions you and I have had about, you know, the cost of video software to the new special effects. I mean, just watching commercials and special effects and commercials now and the quality of blue screen and green screen, you know, two movies I would like to point out as far as low budget films. One is District 9.
That's a good example. $30 million. It looks like a $100 million movie.
$29 to $30 million budget. Second, Pan's Labyrinth, $19 million budget. Those two films by themselves. I mean, looking at everything that. And yes, you know, we've talked about just the mechanics of the Silver Chair. You know, there's no huge battles. There's no, I mean, not like, I'm not trying to say the other.
There better not be.
Yeah.
but seriously, think about it. I mean, the fact that it is a road trip, you know, I mean, even just looking at, just trying to imagine, looking at the BBC version, I mean, that kind of explains, they were able to, they pretty much, I think, had the same budget, I'm assuming, for that one as they did any of the others. And they were able to stretch that much better. Then they
Like in the fact that I'm sure the fact that the whole third act takes place in the dark. I'm sure that's a convenient. You could definitely find ways to cut corners there in the production and make it work.
Especially with the massive digi doubles and all that.
Yeah, and creating giants. You know, there's very cost effective ways of doing that. Hopefully not too cheesy ways, but I really think it's the first act where you've got Aslan. And you got some talking animals there.
Yeah.
That's really your biggest challenge.
But
after
even
that,
then, a lot of the expense for the first one was developing the models, tech, and the I mean, they had to develop that stuff. And that I remember hearing. I mean, we learned that for Prince Caspian, it was less expensive for them to do Aslan in that one than it was in the first one. Now, granted, he did look a little. He didn't.
I don't think he looked as good in Prince Caspian.
He moved better, but he didn't look as good.
Yeah.
But hopefully, by now, I mean, this is going to be coming out more than 10 years, very likely after Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So I would think, I would just like to say, you know, low budget maybe, but even if it's $50 million, it'd be still be considered low budget, and that would be. That would not scare me. I would just like to say that would not scare me. And maybe, Glenfiddle, you could talk about maybe some of the positive aspects that you kind of alluded to.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ransom, you just made me think of one, and that's, we were talking about this battle, and it may be much more difficult for them to say, oh, let's have a big battle at the end. They might just simply not have the money to do that.
I thought of a way, though, if they did have the money, is to just go ahead and finish that gnome invasion breaking out into Narnia from beneath. And that's why I say they had better not, because one of the greatest aspects of the Silver Chair story is the releasing of all the gnomes from the witch's spell. I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it. You still could do that.
If they were to break out, they could, you know, fight for a while, and then they could blow up the droid control ship, and then all.
And then they all fall down. Yeah, and then they all jump. Into the crack in the earth with the lava coming out. Yeah.
Unfortunately,
we are thinking like hack screenwriters now.
I predict they're going to have that scene in there as a foreshadowing. I think it'll be kind of like, you know, the Aragorn death scene in the Two Towers. I think we'll see it, but it'll be something like a vision the queen is talking about. That's my prediction.
Oh, that
I think
would be good.
The positive aspects of a lower budget are, I think, one of the things that one of the problems with Don Treader, to an extent Caspian as well, but had was so many way too many cooks in the kitchen, and there was there's so much money on the line. You cannot expect. I know that officially, I will say this. We've said this over and over and over. Yeah, but Disney didn't have any artistic control. No, but they had a lot of money invested in it. And I don't care how much control you have officially. When you're putting millions and millions of dollars into something, and there's merchandising and, you know, whatever else on the line, this is potentially a huge property for Disney. You throw in your 2 cents and you negotiate any way you can to get it made the way you want.
Well, and the way it works, like with the first one, from my understanding, and it just, you know, I'd just like to say, you know, we should put a little asterisk next to every episode. We know nothing, you know.
Right.
We know nothing.
This is speculative.
It's all some more or less educated guesses. But it seemed like with the first one, maybe less so with Prince Caspian, but certainly with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Disney was kind of hands-off.
I agree. Really, you get the really sense that Disney let Walden and Gresham go make their movie for the most part.
Hey, do their thing. And then Prince Caspian happened, and for a budget business perspective, was not nearly as successful.
Well, after Wardrobe became a hit, it became clear just how much money could potentially be on the line. This might be the beginning of a 7-movie franchise.
Right.
And I think that's when Disney maybe started interfering a little bit more.
And we know that they were definitely, you know, there was more pressure on them for Voyages of Dawn Treader. And even though, you know, people say, well, you know, Voyages of Dawn Treader wasn't as much of a, you know, it wasn't as high budget as the first one. Well, sure, but it still cost $155 million to make. It was, you know, that was still a production budget for Dawn Treader. So,
the major potential positive of this is that if you've got less money on the line, there's probably more room for a director to take more risks and do things that aren't just proven to work, that aren't just proven
that's
formulas.
True.
And of course, that's a great thing if you've got a great director who really does have a great vision for it. Which we don't
and
have.
And the film will benefit from the previous budgets of the previous film, the marketing budgets. There is name recognition now, more so than there was pre-2005 for Narnia. You could spend $50-70 million on the silver chair and get a bigger bang for your buck, which some of the more enterprising studio executives and the people with deep pockets, you know, they love it when one of those comes along. And I imagine part of the sales job for possibly reinvigorating the Narnia franchise is, hey, there's still name recognition here, that all-important name recognition.
Absolutely.
Through the smartphone fog. People will know it. People will know it. And you don't have to spend $150, $200 million in order to make the film if $70 million will do.
And then that's the reason why I for the last few years, I've been thinking, well, eventually they'll probably make the other books. I mean, I didn't think we'd have an announcement this soon, but for heaven's sake, they're making board games in the movies. It's just anything that has any amount of name recognition is being gobbled up and packaged as a movie. So it seemed like it's just a matter of time before someone tries to make the other books. I think that's what's happening here. Hopefully there's actually some genuine inspiration in this. Hopefully someone actually already has a vision for how you can make Silver Chair into a movie, and they're not just forcing it before they actually have an idea.
One last question on the cast crew situation, the logistics of it all before we move into direction. Tyrion said he predicts, like, if they were to announce we are in talks with Andrew Adamson to do the Silver Chair, optimism would go up. What do you guys think?
I think it would. I think I'd feel better.
Yes, it would. Now, I was originally disappointed slightly in Andrew Adamson with Prince Caspian, but like you, Glumpuddle, I understood that the book would have been very difficult and dull to adapt if it was, you know, adapted straightforward. I mean, BBC put it as basically a prequel to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in their version. That's how difficult it was. Nevertheless, I was disappointed with some of the thematic elements of Prince Caspian. And then along came Dawn Treader, and suddenly Andrew Adamson's looking great.
I do not want to minimize the role that Adamson has on his stories, but still, you know, there are screenwriters in addition.
Yeah.
And that is a huge component of that. I really don't want to minimize the direction he takes with it, but I think that Andrew Adamson, I think his love for, clearly he loved the stories a great deal and kind of almost revered them. Sometimes I wonder if it was more the story in his memory than the actual story, but still.
Which he conceded.
To a large extent, I think that's okay.
Yeah. Yes. But still, I mean, the screenwriters are still, that's always been a huge question for me. I mean, that was always with The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I was probably more interested in the screenwriters finding information on their previous stuff they had written than any other.
There have been so many screenwriters.
I know, that was the thing. That was what was so hard. Like, and then we had the leaked script that came out, and we were
we were
freaking out. And we were trying to find out. Wait a minute, is this person? Is this person still involved? You know.
Yes.
Well, at least still alive.
That was the screenwriter, I believe, who was who had the screen credit for Amazing Grace, Michael Apted's previous film.
I think that with the first two films, I think Adamson had a vision that people kind of rallied behind and got excited about, screenwriters included. If Adamson was hired again, I think, come on, be honest with yourself. Wouldn't you feel a certain sense of security?
Yes.
Yes, I
think it's maybe a little more likely to happen is kind of a Michael Apted thing where it's someone who's not a huge director, but you read their IMDb and you go, oh, okay, he's directed a lot of stuff, but is not a big star director or anything. Mm-hmm, and probably someone that Mark Gordon has worked with before. That's kind of what I'm expecting. I'd start getting really excited about the possibilities if Andrew Adamson was.
I would too. And I think
most people
for one reason. I mean, I can give one piece of evidence to remind people. The man put pictures from the magician's nephew on the wardrobe.
Yeah.
I mean, he did not carve them himself, but I believe if I recall my behind the scenes, if I recall my memory of the DVD material, I believe that was his idea. Yeah. That's my memory of the material. You know, so I'm working according to that. But I mean, that's dedication, people. Yeah. That's wait a minute. No, this book, you know, references that and it's subtlety. That's the line.
And one thing I know that some people have, because I was looking through the forums and what people are saying there. And I think there's a sense that the Lewis estate is more involved with this one than maybe the earlier films, but that will not save us. I mean, it's great to have.
Yes,
it is great to have, but here is a great example, you know, and Glenpool and I think we talked about this. I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but, you know, think about, I think the most involvement the Tolkien estate gave to the Lord of the Rings was, I think Tolkien's great-grandson had a cameo as a ranger in the third movie. And I think that's pretty much the only involvement I've heard of. And yet, they had far less involvement from the estate than, say, The Voyages on Treader did with Doug Gresham.
Uh-huh.
But which was closer? You know, Doug Gresham, yes, he won battles, but he could only pull so much. I'm not going to blame him.
And that's probably why. I mean, like, he wants to make the film independently now.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, that won't save you. If you don't have a director and just an overall crew cast who understand but also respect and love the source material, then having input from the estate is not going to help you. You know,
right. They'll say, thanks, estate, for your input. We're going to go
exactly,
do this now.
Exactly.
Right. But with the lower budget, there's much more the estate can have more say in this. Mm-hmm. And that can be good and bad because, I don't know, sometimes people have weird ideas that sound like, oh, that's so different from the book. But it's actually a good idea. It's actually in the spirit of it. And I don't know. More estate involvement could be good, could be bad. So – where do we go from here in terms of story?
Do you think they're going to reference the previous film?
My concerns about that kind of hit on that, about how much continuity with the other movies do you
exactly.
keep? And I would just be – honestly, I just want to make something that is essentially a standalone film called The Silver Chair. I'd be in favor of taking the Chronicles of Narnia out of the title and just calling it The Silver Chair. That won't happen. But I would I think it's a good book. I think it has potential to be a good movie. And I would like to basically see a fresh start.
You need to keep the Chronicles of Narnia in there for name recognition.
Right. That's why. That's
one
why
of the one of the marketing missteps of Prince Caspian was putting Prince Caspian right up front instead of the Pevensies. Who's this guy? Who is this guy?
Right.
When Star Trek decided they wanted to have a prequel TV series, they decided to get all clever and call it Enterprise,
which was a
mistake, you know, and I realized, I mean, I think that series is underappreciated too. Not the best, but anyway, they had to restore it to Star Trek : Enterprise by about, you know, the second or third, fourth season, I forget which. You have to keep the Chronicles of Narnia : The Silver Chair.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And I'm kind of with Glenpool here. I would just say, it's sort of funny where sometimes people try to make a story and it's like, well, we'll acknowledge this existed, but not this. Like Superman Returns, you know, like, well, we'll acknowledge the first film, you know, first two films existed, right, but not the right. other ones. We don't, we
kind
deny those existed.
Continuous, yeah. Yes.
But, you know, like a simple example is I wonder about, like, I was kind of course, my jaw was already on the floor by the time The Voyage of Dawn Treader ended for other reasons, but then, of course, it fell even lower through the floor when I saw, they got the line, hey, your friend Joe Powell is, you know, here to see you. And I thought, wait, what? They're friends? You know, like, what kind of rotten stinker is she?
Yeah, which is maybe a potential that. Problem.
Yeah, and so I just thought, yeah, I would just, frankly, I would just have them, you know,
because, like, well, the idea for me, I think one of the important ideas in the Silver Chair is that Jill has nowhere to turn to, and she's very, very much alone at the beginning of Silver Chair.
Yeah. Eustace is foreign to her in the Silver Chair.
I would just have
Eustace is the
line.
Creep from the previous term who has just happened to win her over temporarily. She is shy. She's scared. Everyone is an enemy to her. Even Aslan becomes that. That's what strengthens their scene in the opening of the Silver Chair because, as you said, she has nowhere to turn. Eustace is gone. She's feeling the guilt of. I mean, mm-hmm. she has basically done this to a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
She can't be friends.
She has no one she can trust. Yes. Like she right. can't trust. Her leaders at school. She's mm-hmm. one of the few, really the only, I think the only child character in the series whose parents are never mentioned. The mutual friend
yes.
of ours pointed that out, brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you wonder if maybe she can't even trust in her parents. And then she comes to this lion who gives her these four kind of sort of vague, ambiguous signs to follow, and of course, it's not that surprising. She has a hard time trusting that because it's been. I think it sounds like it's been a long time since she's been able to trust in anyone. So I think it might weaken that a little bit if you say her and Eustace have been friends for a while. Maybe it's a little more powerful if she has no one to turn to.
Here's the thing. Who's gonna remember? Really?
Exactly.
Who is
only
really
the dedicated fans, and we're not going to complain.
that's
not a
true.
Bit.
That is exactly true. That's why I say just ignore it. I think they should just say, you know, okay, yeah, we're not rebooting the series as in starting it, but we're restarting it. You know?
Well, we don't know why Jill Pohl dropped in for a visit. Maybe she was just delivering something. I don't know.
They'll just pick, you know, they'll do a digital Will Poulter, and, you know, he'll come to the door, and she'll throw a tomato in
there
his face
go.
And walk
you
off.
Know, all the talk is about, is Puddle Glum going to be CGI? Just do a CG Will Poulter, and you've got your continuity.
I actually think that the Puddle Glum CGI might be a big budget thing because, I mean, Tumnus's legs were kind of a new thing at the
Puddle
time.
Glum's he's not going to be CGI, and he doesn't.
Well, his legs need to be, possibly his arms.
They need to be if you're absolutely hell-bent on making Puddle Glum look exactly as Lewis describes him, which is, you know, very long, skinny arms where his body is not much bigger than a dwarf's. But he has his super – I mean, it's the same reason Gollum had to be CGI. But if you, like me, are willing to compromise on that – I mean, I would love to see a fully real – Lewis's vision fully realized. But I don't know. I think that he's not – he's humanoid enough to where I'd be fine with him just wearing loose clothing and putting makeup on. And I just see so much value out of having a real physical actor there on set. And, you know, I love Lewis's description of Puddle Glum, but it's the character that I care about the most.
But trust me, the real physical actor would absolutely be there. I mean, I think that you ask Elijah Wood or Sean Astin, I mean, I think that Andy Serkis was as much a force on set as anyone else, but he was also a force for the digital guys, maybe more so. And I think they should do is just say, okay, what do we have to work with? What can we put towards a digital Puddle Glum and make sure it's done well? And if we can't do it well without, you know, compromising other aspects of the film, we shouldn't do it at all, you know.
I don't think it's with if this is a ginormous budget, I'd say maybe since it's a small budget, I'd rather have them take all the money that would have gone into CG Puddle Glum and put it all into Aslan. I'm perfectly fine with compromising on the way Puddle Glum is described in the book and just hire a tall guy, have him lose as much weight as he can, and I'm fine with that.
I would go with that. See, I was thinking something more like how Mr. Tumnus was done, which was a you know a human actor.
Yeah,
half and half. A human actor, you know, but, you know, do some mocap CG legs. You know, that's getting less expensive, though. You know, they're getting better at blending the two together.
But if there's a limited budget, though, I can just think of other things I'd much rather have it be spent on.
What?
Yeah.
Like Aslan. I mean, like...
Aslan's country as well.
Aslan's country.
I just think a CG lion with... I mean, with any kind of budget, a believable CG lion that needs to have... Aslan needs to make an impression on this. And I'm worried about them saying, you know, he only has, like, one scene at the beginning, and then you kind of see him later. But why spend so much money on a character that we're only going to use for one scene? But if he doesn't make a really powerful impression on Jill and the audience...
Right. No, I agree.
Her struggle to follow the signs, which is the whole central emotional conflict of the book, isn't going to have a lot of weight. So Aslan needs to really stand out in people's minds and memories throughout the entire film. And honestly, I just think if there's... Like what you're saying, what would I rather have it spent on? Just about anything. I just think it's not Paul Glum as a real person, as a tall, skinny guy, is perfectly fine to me. I just don't see any reason to do CGI.
I can compromise with that for sure. I mean, we can have a tall, skinny guy with green Jell-O between his fingers. That's fine with me.
Yeah, we kind of got that with the BBC version.
Exactly.
I'd like to get better makeup than the BBC version.
True.
I think Tom Baker was a pretty good Puddle Glum.
Yeah.
And so that more than made up for it for me. Puddle Glum is, of course, my favorite character in all the series. And just super looking forward to seeing how they do him. And I just want to – the most important thing to me is not how he looks. The most important thing is the character. And what I'm most I'm a little concerned that they're going to take the easy way out and make Puddle Glum just an Eeyore, gloomy, depressed character. And
not him. He's an optimist to his people. That's the humor of it.
Yeah, exactly. Like as Marshmiggles go, he's actually, you know, he actually is probably something of an optimist to them. It's sort of the joke. But even beyond that, I think there's an argument to be made that Puddle Glum is an optimist in general because, and hear me out, I see him as someone who's always voicing the worst possible scenario, but I don't see him being depressed about that. When he's saying, "Oh, I think it's going to rain," I don't think he's saying it with fear or like he's annoyed. He's saying it as a fact. It's just the way it is, and we'll have to deal with it.
The key there is he's not saying out of fear. He's the least likely of all the characters to give up.
Absolutely.
And so that makes him optimistic.
Yeah, and so I see him as a character who's always kind of thinking the worst thing is going to happen, but not being too concerned about it because he's always talking about, I'm just going to put a bold face on it. What's going to happen is going to happen. And, of course, there's other – so I don't think it's as simple as he's just a gloomy, depressed character. It's much more interesting than that. And so I really hope they realize that about Puddle Glum. And ultimately – even though he's always suspecting the worst thing is going to happen, though not all the time, sometimes he's comically optimistic, like when they're underground and he says it'll save funeral expenses. But bottom line, he always does the right thing. If he does have any fear, he doesn't let it affect his actions. Like when they have to decide if they're going to free Rillian from the chair, he says, you know, he actually thinks Rillian is going to kill them. But it doesn't matter. We have to do the right thing. We have to follow Aslan's signs. And so if Puddle Glum does have any fear, it only makes him that much more noble of a character because he ultimately does the right thing regardless of how he feels. So that's the essence of Puddle Glum to me. However they do him technically, that's how they have to do the character.
That is an excellent point. They have to understand that, and they also have to understand why this particular character for this particular story. And there are several reasons, of course, that Lewis chose Puddle Glum, but he is a complement to the theme. The theme is obedience. The theme is faithfulness, no matter the opposition. Mm-hmm. Whereas the first three Chronicles of Narnia, with a slight exception of Prince Caspian, were very joy-oriented. They were about delight. They were about discovery, adventure, exploration, giving everything for Aslan's country. The Silver Chair is very grounded. It's very, well, quite literally, earthy. You have your directive. You obey your directive. Even if you're not happy, even if you're not dancing with fawns, even if you're not in a luxurious Narnian tent or a castle. I knew someone would do it.
I wonder how many... That's one thing I'm looking forward to.
We were doing very well so far.
Honestly, that's one thing I'm looking forward to is how many people accidentally say Glumpuddle on this podcast.
Just because
I'm
going to
start keeping our tally. And that's number one.
Should.
Congratulations.
Seriously. You're going to die and go to heaven when you're watching the bloopers one day for the silver chair.
That's true, and they say Glumpuddle.
I really hope the person that types up the credits is an Arnie Weber. Let me just say that.
Yes. That would be, I mean, and you would get paid for that mention. You know, you have the copyright on that reverse on those reverse syllables. But that is why Puddle Glum is perfect for that story, because he speaks that earthiness and literally into the story of that. You pick your duty and you stick with it, even if something bad happens. You know, even if you're not happy, even if there's no joy, even if you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And I hope that theme comes through loud and clear in the adaptation.
That is an important theme in the story. For me, when I think of Silver Chair, I think of, maybe this is because I identify with this so much, is Jill's struggle to put her trust in somebody. Whether it's her parents, and I know that's just implied, or whether it's people at school. She just has no kind of leadership figure she can kind of just put her trust in. Mm-hmm. And she's like struggling to really just, because people let you down. It's the reality of it. But you can't just, this is something I've struggled with in my own life, is people let me down, and I have struggled to just really believe in people, even though I get worried about getting hurt. And I think that's Jill, is she's she's worried about getting hurt, so she's struggling to trust and invest in people. And I see the silver chair as her journey, struggling to put her trust in someone, that being Aslan. But ultimately, she gets there. But partially through Puddle Glum's example, that Puddle Glum puts himself out there. He chooses to follow Aslan's signs. He chooses, even though he believes that Rillian is actually going to kill them, he does it anyway, and it all turns out okay. And so I think Jill sees that and says, wow, you know what? There are people out there that you can trust, and you can't live in fear. You can't just choose not to trust in people because you're afraid of them letting you down. Mm-hmm. People will do that, but you can't go through life living in fear.
And what a fantastic theme to explore. I can't think of any films that have explored that. You'll get a rom-com with, Brenda Sue needs to learn to love again. But, in a fantasy film, it's distracting enough to go into the believe in yourself themes. But
don't run
like
from who you are.
Don't run from who you are. Well, in this case, Jill does need to run from who she is and learn to trust. And by the end, the story does not let her off the hook either. And yet there's such grace there at the last when Jill finally meets Aslan again. And he forgives. It's subtle. It's beautiful, and yet at the same time, the obedience theme is there.
Jill's the main character, but Puddle Glum just represents the essence of it so much. In the same way that Reepy Cheep isn't technically the main character. Oh, so, I've heard a lot of arguments that Reepy Cheep is the protagonist in Dawn Treader, but regardless, I don't think he is. But he represents the heart of what Dawn Treader is about.
Yeah, he's kind of the driving force of Dawn Treader.
Yeah. Yeah, so Puddle Glum, definitely one of the things I think everyone's looking forward to. Certainly, absolutely, one of the character everyone is really excited about.
It would be a toss up to say who is braver, he or Reepy Cheep. It really would be.
Honestly, I would say Puddle Glum is braver, just because
I
he's
know you
always.
Would.
Of course, I would.
In
because
different
I
ways,
see Puddle,
they're braver
I think
in different Reepy ways.
Cheep, I just see Puddle Glum as the fact that he's always voicing the worst possible scenario and just thinking, oh, I think the worst possible scenario is going to happen. But then he does it anyway. I see that as the definition of bravery. That's the definition of courage. You can't really be courageous without knowing there is something to fear here. And honestly, I just think Reepy Cheep often just doesn't feel fear. I just think his love of Aslan and of Narnia and of everything he stands for, I almost wonder if he doesn't feel fear a lot of the time.
Mm. They are different characters, brave in different ways. Puddle Glum is dutifully courageous. Reepy Cheep is romantically courageous.
That is,
Puddle Glum, he's the type of chap who would read biographies and perhaps engineering manuals. And Reepy Cheep reads the fairy tales and listens to the classical music. They're different personalities, There's the old false but still helpful distinguishing a dichotomy of left brain and right brain.
Right.
Puddle Glum, left brain. Reepy Cheep, right brain.
Okay, what challenges do you think? We've talked about some of them, so maybe some of this will be kind of rehashed, but just maybe summarize what you think are some of the challenges facing this film. Chief
Turn
challenges.
Off the
There's
green
lot,
mist
obviously.
Generators. Turn them off. Keep them in storage, and that includes the,
no, don't put them in storage.
The CG
just
renderers.
Can we just say the burden of the previous film?
White Witch.
No.
No. No.
Lady of the
Green
Girdle,
Witch.
Yes.
Green Witch. Nicole Kidman.
Please, no Tilda Swinton in this, please.
No. We love her, however.
Now we're sick of her.
What? The Magician's Nephew.
She'll come back for the Magician's Nephew.
She'll be too old.
No, she won't. She'll be old enough to play herself younger because she gets... Oh, whatever. It's for another But it's okay if the White Witch looks older, because then she can become immortal at the end, and she can look younger. That's my idea.
Mm-hmm. Digi Clinton. Mm-hmm, that's true. Tilda Swinton. Digi Tilda.
Can you imagine if they had Tilda Swinton in all the movies except Magician's Nephew? Like, they had to recast her for that?
Oh, that would be... Wow. Tilda Swinton as Tash.
Oh, gosh. No, stop it! Okay, now we know who to blame if that happens.
It's my fault. I'm selling out. I want the money from that idea.
Favorite scenes, anyone?
I think Glumpuddle and I agree on at least our first, perhaps top favorite scene to be filmed that we want to see. We want to see realized and adapted directly from the book would be the scene where Jill meets Aslan. I want the dialogue direct, almost with the same yearning that I wanted to hear Aslan's lines at the end of Voyage to the Dawn Treader.
Uh-huh. And I think that it's the scene where Jill meets Aslan is a strong candidate for my favorite scene in the whole series. I love it just doesn't play out how you expect it. Aslan doesn't behave the way you expect him to. Like when Jill says, "Do you eat girls?" And I think he kind of laughed at the question. And then Aslan says, "I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms." And you kind of go, "Whoa." And exactly. Aslan is, and I think he has to leave such a strong impression on Jill for that to work. And it's, I love the way the scene is written. I think it's one of the best dialogue scenes in the series. I love watching, again, it's Jill taking a baby step towards trusting. She chooses to trust Aslan, but only because the only other choice is dying of thirst. So it's a baby step. Aslan's going to give her a bigger test after that, but it really cannot just be a plot thing. It can't just be, the point of this scene is to, you know, establish that the prince has gone and give Jill her task. If they just treat it that way, we just have to get the plot moving, it's not going to work. You have to understand that this is the basis for the whole movie, that Jill's struggle to trust in Aslan.
I think the scene I am most looking forward to, that scene did come into my mind as a second or third scene I'd most want to see. It was one of the first to come to my mind. I am really looking forward to seeing, maybe this sounds cheap, but to see the dialogue lifted from the book really well in the dialogue scene with the Green Witch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just that discussion with the lamp.
It's going to be interesting to see how they film that.
It could be done so poorly, but it's so captivating in the book. It has so much power. And so maybe that's the scene I'm most looking forward to. But one scene that definitely comes to my mind as a scene I just want to be done so well is the scene at the end.
With the silver chair itself.
Well, no, actually I wasn't thinking the silver chair.
No, back in Aslan's country.
I was thinking back in Aslan's country where Jill and Eustace are with Aslan. The power of that scene
Will Ben Barnes come back to have a little cameo?
Yeah,
there.
I know. I was thinking about that. But.
And the comedic impact of going back to set things right at Experiment House, which closes a loop within the book, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder, will we actually see on film them beating kids with the flats of their swords?
Yes.
I don't think it'll happen.
If an American studio gets involved,
awesome.
It will never happen.
Yes, but see, Lewis pones British education at the time, and that, you know, it's not going to upset anyone now. That's all gone, and in the 1940s now, it's not going to be any skin off anyone's nose if they critique 1940s, you know, bad schools. And even Lewis says that at the end, the right people got a hold of the school, and it became a much nicer school.
Maybe we don't have to see them hitting him with the flats of their blades, but can we at least see the looks on their faces when Aslan and Jill and Eustace, you know, with their weapons and everything, come charging back at them? Can we please at least see the look of shock on their faces, and the head, you know, having a total freak out and calling the police and everything?
Maybe at the end of the film, the last shot you see will just be like this, you know, still frame of the screaming students, you know, kind of blurring into the ends.
Like, it shows their reaction. The very last shot in the movie is a slow-mo Jill and Eustace charging with swords. Fade to black. But I'm just, regardless of what's going to happen, I'm looking forward to sharing this experience with all of you. And I do think that as fans who this book is so important to us, and it means so much more to us than just an entertaining fantasy story.
Oh, yeah.
If we don't stand up for it, you know, who is? You know, we have to an extent hold the filmmakers accountable, I think, and say, look, this is not just a movie you're making.
Discussing these things with other fans who
yep.
love the books and discussing these ideas and these
you're
stories
not alone.
And these characters, that has been
you
so
are
much
not
fun.
Alone.
I'm glad for the journey, even if, of course, I hope and would love to see this be a fantastic film, but I really, I'm going to enjoy the journey.
All our listeners, there is a discussion forum. Please go there, check it out, you know, or post a comment on this page. You can send us an email.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. This has been great.
Further up and further in.
Only in theaters on Respectabagel 37th, 2011.